Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Sometime in the past 30 years, liberal became a loaded word. The Democratic Party that brought America a New Deal on Social Security under FDR, civil rights and the Great Society under LBJ, suffered two blistering defeats in 1972 and 84, when Republicans painted both George McGovern and Walter Mondale as out-of-touch liberals who'd give the store away. Democrats didn't get the White House back until a smooth-talking Southern governor rode personal charm and centrist politics all the way to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Now, facing another George Bush, you might think the last thing Democrats would want is to lean to the left. So, explain the appeal of Howard Dean, who's topping the Democratic wannabes in fundraising and buzz, and calling himself the progressive candidate. He says he represents the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. Connection listeners, is leaning left the way for Democrats to win in 2004? Or is the party flirting with another 49-state Republican landslide? What does Dean's success so far tell us about what voters want to hear in a time of an uncertain economy, a war on terrorism, and budget deficits in the triple billion digits? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And this hour, we're going to be hearing from a number of Democrats who disagree about where the party should be in 2004. But first, we're going to go to Iowa City and hear from two people who are busily out pounding the pavement for Howard Dean. And they're joining us from NPR station WSUI. Brian Tibbetts is a high school English and Latin teacher who's been volunteering for Dean since February, the first time he's ever become involved in presidential politics. Hi, Brian.
Good morning.
And your wife, Megan Scott, is also a Dean volunteer now running meetups in Iowa City. Hello, Megan.
Hi there. Good morning.
You know, that's a new word for many of us, Megan. What is a meetup and what does that have to do with the Dean campaign?
That's a great question. A meetup is essentially exactly what it sounds like. It's a place for people who have similar interests to get together and talk and do different things. Meetup is actually not specifically focused on Dean. It's a national, I guess, movement that you can meet up for anything. But the Dean campaign, I think, really early on sort of found this meetup group and has made it a really amazing tool to organize people who are interested in Howard Dean. So the first Wednesday of every month at 7 p.m., people in different parts of the country, they have meetups in, oh gosh, over 50 cities, if not more than that, across the country. You get together at 7 and talk about Howard Dean and try and organize events in your community and really just spread the word and educate people on his candidacy.
Hmm. So, Brian, how did you get interested in Dean? You had not been interested that much, apparently, in politics for most of your 20s.
Yes, that's correct. My first experience with Dean was he came and spoke at Prairie Lights Bookstore here in Iowa City early in November this year, right, and heard him speak and was really turned on, but it wasn't until we saw him at an event in Vinton, Iowa at a small little cafe where he really just electrified the crowd, as small crowd as it was, but everything he said really kind of hit home to me. And just the passion with which he spoke, I really said, hey, this is somebody that I could really support. This sounds like a candidate that speaks to me, not just somebody I'm going to follow just because of, oh, yeah, sure, I followed the platform. But this was somebody whose energy and personality fit directly in with the message, and that's what I really liked about him.
So, Brian, was it the energy and the passion, or was it the specifics? Are you with him on every issue?
Oh, no, I'm not with him on every issue. I don't think any free-thinking person should be with every candidate on every single issue. But I'm there with most of the issues, and it's more the energy and the passion with which he's behind those issues. And unabashedly so, if someone says, hey, I don't agree with you on this, he says, I understand that, but get with me on something that you believe in if you're going to be behind my campaign. If you agree on some things, take a look at me. Can you forgive me for some of this other stuff? He says what he thinks, and he speaks what he feels, and I think that's very attractive for a lot of voters nowadays.
Well, this is still early, as you know. Is it possible that this is still the honeymoon phase, and later on you're going to see something that you don't like so much, Megan?
You know, I don't know. We've been following, oh gosh, for 6 months now. And, you know, he just keeps getting better every time that I see him. And again, I'm like, Brian, you know, I don't agree with him on 100% of the issues, but But the core issues that what he stands for really, really turns me on. And it's been amazing to sort of watch his wild ride. I mean, when we first started supporting Howard Dean, no one really knew who he was. And we were sort of having to justify ourselves all the time. And now he's everywhere. And the momentum that he's gaining is really phenomenal. And I honestly, I just see that going up and up. I don't think it's a honeymoon phase at this point.
Brian, where were you last time in 2000?
In 2000, I was a I voted for Gore, and but I was a voter who did not feel like I had a candidate in the 2000 election. Looking back on it, I probably would have voted Nader had I been a little bit more involved. But I was begrudgingly voting Gore just because it was just the message that time. It was the platform that I more agreed with than the Republican message, and I just had not gotten enough information about Nader or chosen to kind of go out and do my homework before the vote, and I felt that I could not vote for Nader on those grounds. So I was kind of a begrudging Gore supporter back in 2000.
And you as well, Megan?
Actually, no. We had a lot of arguments at home about this, actually. I was a Gore supporter, mainly because I had seen him speak a lot of times. And I did like his message, and I did like him as a candidate. But I do understand why Brian felt the way he did. It was really, 2000 election was incredibly frustrating to stand back and watch in so many ways.
Now, of course, Howard Dean was, if not the first, one of the early Democratic candidates to come out against the war in Iraq. I wonder how much that resonated both with you folks and with the other people that you come in contact with in Iowa.
Well, it's an issue, I think, that some people that got him into the headlines, definitely. And so some people who were definitely anti-war, and Iowa definitely has its share, and Iowa City definitely has its share. However, I'm found that my own interest in Dean was really on his domestic platform. It was, okay, sure, he's anti-war. Sure, he has very good reasons and back that up, and I'll argue that till the cows come home. However, I really am so supportive of Dean because I believe he has put so much thought and effort and time into his domestic agenda, and so therefore people say, oh, well, he's just the anti-war candidate. That's going to fade fast. No, if you really look at it, he has laid out a very detailed plan for health care, for education, trade, for civil rights, things of that nature that I think all Iowans that we're in contact with, especially at the meetups, that are very passionate about this thing, the environment's another one. Those are the things that people latch on to. The war stance really, I don't think, has the kind of weight that the domestic issues really carries.
I mean, at first, that was one of the reasons he sort of really caught my attention, because that was an important issue for me. I didn't really agree with the war and had a lot of questions about it. And it was great to hear him standing up and speaking out on that stance. But I'm like Brian, once the war issue sort of got me in the door, and then it's really his domestic issues and his other policies that have kept me there and have kept me really going out and supporting him on a very active level.
All right. Well, Brian and Megan, stay with us for a minute. I want to bring Eric Hauser into the conversation as well. He's the founder and president of the Hauser Group, which develops communication strategies for progressive causes. And he was also press secretary for Bill Bradley's campaign for the Democratic nomination in 2000. So, Eric, as you're hearing this conversation, does all of this bring you back, all the Dean buzz? Because a few years ago, it was Bill Bradley who was getting this kind of positive reaction.
Good morning. It brings me back to that and to many long van rides across the great state of Iowa. many meetups, even though they were called something different 4 years ago. It is very interesting, and of course the people of Iowa and New Hampshire have a unique advantage in political life in that they have this stage in front of them and get to participate and judge over what's now an incredibly long period of time, a full year before the caucus in Iowa. The campaign began a full year. So it's a fascinating laboratory to look at and to be a part of.
Do you see this, Eric, as the almost usual infatuation with a new face, because Gary Hart and John Anderson and John McCain and I guess Bill Bradley could offer a lesson here?
Yes and no. I mean, it could be that fascination with a new face. It could not be. The interesting thing is it's quite early. It's the middle of July. three or four elections ago, the campaign hadn't even begun by this point. So I think Howard Dean is a very solid candidate, and as a professional, I look at a lot of tactical things and how they put their organization together. Their use of the internet is brilliant, and that is a tactical skill. It's not just an idea. He's going to have to be very careful over the next 7 months that he doesn't coast. And it was interesting to hear one of your other guests talk about his impact being greater as he's gone along. I think that's important. It is a long time from now until the snowy days of February.
Right. It's a marathon, not a sprint.
It's a marathon, mm-hmm. and he needs to take care of his body. They need to have a plan for what they're going to do in September now. You know, they need to act like they need to see themselves in a whole new light than 6 months ago without losing that same energy that brought people, that brought him to this place. That's a very difficult thing to do, but that's the test.
And also, isn't it pretty risky being the early on front runner or being perceived as that? Because then you have all your other Democratic brethren gunning for you.
Well, indeed. I in our experience, I think our no pun intended here, our nadir was, with an I, was in mid-October of 99. And, you know, I remember a few of us thinking we're hitting that point too early. We did not want to wake up the sitting vice president too early, and we did. And he got organized and had an enormous amount of power behind him. And once he was focused, it was very hard to beat him. So, yeah, in a way, it would have been better for Howard Dean to sneak up. But that's now passed, so they have to adjust. And that'll be a very interesting political test.
Brian and Megan, I want to ask each of you quickly, are you concerned that you may be living in a little progressive bubble where you are and that the rest of the country perhaps doesn't feel the same way you do? The issues that you care about might win the battle but lose the war. Brian?
Sorry.
Go ahead, Megan.
We often feel that way. Iowa City is a really unique place to live in the whole state of Iowa, and I think and in the Midwest. And so I do sometimes feel like we're in a bubble where this is a highly Democratic county that we're living in, you know, very active people. But we recently were on vacation, and we went to a meetup in Memphis, Tennessee, and they had over 50 people at this meetup, and the energy that we felt in that room was amazing. This is a state that doesn't have a primary that's, you know, right on at the top of the list. And a lot of people, you know, politically aren't paying attention to Tennessee at this point. But those people were just as active in Memphis, Tennessee, as we are here in Iowa City. And that was truly amazing.
And Brian, just very quickly, let me ask, if someone mm-hmm. else gets the nomination, will you still be involved?
Yeah, I'll think about it. It's a tough call right now. There's so many candidates. And so, but I would definitely, I think one thing this has done is keep me politically involved, and I hope to stay there.
All right. Connection listeners, we have been talking with Megan Scott and Brian Tibbetts, two Democrats from Iowa City who are definitely feeling the Howard Dean buzz. Do you agree that left-leaning Democrats may get nominated but seldom get elected president? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. Exactly 1 year and 2 days from now, the Democrats will be assembled in Boston to choose their nominee. What happens right now, from Iowa to the internet, is going to determine who that is. We're talking this hour about the energy that's being generated right now over Howard Dean and the question being asked by Democrats. Is it savvy or suicidal to nominate a Democrat who leans to the left or is being portrayed as leaning to the left? We're turning to Democratic strategists to help us answer that one. Eric Hauser is president of the Hauser Group, which advises progressive politicians and organizations. He was Bill Bradley's press secretary in his run for the Democratic nomination in 2000. Eric, help us out with some of the nomenclature here. It's fascinating that the L word is so seldom used anymore. The folks who used to describe themselves as liberals are now saying they are progressives. So what does that tell us about the internal struggle for the soul of the Democratic Party, and why would going left be a recipe for victory at this point?
Well, in order, those are two different questions, and they're both good, and they're, of course, related. I think that there has been a generation of fear of being called a liberal, and fear creates weakness and indecision and uncertainty, and it's going to take some time to recover from that, but I think there is a good effort underway to make that recovery. I'm happy to use the word progressive. I'm happy to use the word liberal. But in politics, as in any competition, once you are timid with your opponent, they will find that timidity and drive a stake through it. And when we began to be timid about liberalism and what it means and what it stands for and the legacy of FDR and Truman and Lyndon Johnson, we didn't have a chance, and so got backed into a corner of centrism merely as a way to survive amidst the fear we'd created for ourselves. So it's going to take a while, and it's an interesting historical story, and it at least people are now beginning to say, I'm liberal and I'm proud, or I'm progressive and I'm proud, and we can't go anywhere without that, so it's a good start.
I want to bring Ed Kilgore into the conversation as well. He's joining us from his vacation in Florida. So, Ed, thanks so much for giving up some of your vacation time. I should mention as well.
As we know, it's never too early to start politicking in Florida.
Absolutely. I should also mention that you are policy director for the Democratic Leadership Council, which favors centrist Democratic candidates. So pick up on what Eric was saying about the struggle for the soul of the party, because certainly Bill Clinton went to the center and did just fine.
Yeah, and I have to, it's really interesting the way Eric put it, because we would have to really take issue with the basic premise here that Clinton-style centrism is some sort of tactical accommodation to the fear of being labeled as liberal, and it's really deceptive, and it really doesn't indicate what we want to do as Democrats. We would argue that what is now, for the most part, called centrism in the Democratic Party is an authentic Democratic tradition that goes back to the very saints that people on the left like to cite. For example, one issue on which people divide centrists and we claim the word progressive too, so I hate to concede it, but centrists in the left is military action overseas. Well, we think there's a powerful Democratic tradition that goes from Wilson to Truman to John F. Kennedy and beyond, that it's an authentic progressive tradition. It's an authentic part of the Democratic Party. We think what Bill Clinton did was really bring the Democratic Party kind of back to its senses and to create a coalition of people across a range of issues that could include a majority of the American people. So obviously, if you think that the Clinton legacy is one of fear and deception and refusal to admit what you're for, then that you might very well want to move away from that now. But I deny the premise fundamentally. For us, the things Bill Clinton did, even on issues like welfare reform and crime and national defense, were progressive in the fundamental sense of adapting the progressive political tradition to new times and dealing with a full range of issues that affect the American people instead of conceding them to the opposition. So we're not ashamed of centrism at all. There's nothing deceptive about it. There's nothing to apologize for. And it's not about fear. It's about building a progressive majority in this country.
Eric, I have to believe you want to weigh in on that.
Well, I do. And it's, I don't decry the DLC or anyone else with a moderate point of view from having that point of view. I think what is distressing about it is that it gives so much away. It gives so much opportunity away. And it is, to me, Bill Clinton is, in Ed's description, such an anomaly. And to my mind, Bill Clinton was elected for two reasons. One, his populist charm, and two, Ross Perot. And all of a sudden, Democrat, and believe me, I'm one of them, who's been out of power for a long time, was in love. We had power for the first time, and we just stopped and looked up at this charming, debonair man and said all our problems are solved because he's not going to alienate anyone too badly, and wow, isn't he wonderful, and can he raise money? So this idea that there is this trend toward moderation, I think is completely made up. I think Bill Clinton made the DLC, certainly not the other way around, and that while there are certainly plenty of moderate voters in the country, and there should be, there is not a moderate movement. And anyone who lives in Fort Wayne or in Frankfort, Kentucky, or a place that's outside the Beltway in the East Coast that's struggling with a lousy public school and lousy wages and lousy child care and lousy unemployment insurance system and a basic economy that when they get out of bed in the morning, they have to struggle just to get to the end of the day and they're still $20 short every month. Those are the basic economic justice issues that the history of liberalism has attended to, that this claim of a new moderate mantle completely overlooks. I'm actually not going to argue with that about the tradition of progressive Democrats supporting action overseas. I think that's a very legitimate point. I don't disagree with that at all. But at home, the one-third of the country that is struggling so hard to just survive, that's the base of the Democratic Party. And it's only when progressives embrace that and say, we will speak to you and your values aggressively, like Howard Dean is doing, then we've got a shot to reclaim a genuine base of long-term political support and not an accident of history that combined a third-party candidate and the charm of Bill Clinton.
Eric, I need to jump in here because I want to hear quickly from Ed on this point, and then we have a lot of listeners who want to get in on the conversation.
Yeah, I really, again, have to challenge the premise. The proudest accomplishment of the Clinton administration was reversing 30 years of stagnation or declines in real earning power for middle-class people. The economic accomplishments of the 1990s are pretty obvious in retrospect. They look pretty good right now. Practically every economic and social condition in the country improved dramatically. They're now declining dramatically. And Eric, I don't know where you get your information about the DLC, but we obsessively and redundantly and constantly attack the Bush administration for not simply for bad economic policies, but for lacking any at all. And I certainly don't think there's anything inconsistent with being a centrist Democrat and being highly critical of the Bush administration for abandoning the kind of consensus economic policies that worked so well in the 1990s. So I don't think it's a choice between a candidate that's willing to criticize the Bush administration aggressively and one that's not. I think something else is going on with the Dean campaign that I think really flows more from his opposition to the war in Iraq, and that it could possibly create a very damaging negative stereotype for the Democratic Party if he is nominated as he is currently campaigning, which I frankly think he's kind of adjusting himself right now.
Okay, Ed, hold the thought because I'm sure we're going to get back to that. But let's go first to Durham, North Carolina, and hear from Jim. Hello, Jim.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I believe that the future of the Democratic Party lies in the 60% of eligible voters that don't bother voting. And the progressive agenda, it seems to me, is totally a winning agenda. I mean, the majority of people in this country support environmental protection. In a poll last fall, 70% of them said that corporations have too much control over their lives. And, a candidate that can, I mean, your own callers, your first two interviewers were saying that, I never saw a candidate running for office that spoke to me. That says something. And, we can fight, continue to fight over, quibble over a centrist, the centrist voters when there's, huge majorities that are just dying for somebody to speak to them.
Okay, Jim, point taken. Let's throw that one to Ed because, Ed, there does seem to be a case for you could take Al Gore's votes plus Ralph Nader's votes, and those would add up to a pretty decisive victory in 2000.
Well, you could add Al Gore's votes and the votes of the, Socialist Workers Party candidate, too. I mean, in a tie election, actually an election where Al Gore won, plurality.
A popular vote, right.
I don't think that's quite the point. You could get a few extra votes anywhere, including from the opposition. But I think the caller raises two interrelated points that are kind of interesting. One, and it reminds me of Eric's last comment, the idea that Howard Dean is the only candidate out there talking about the environment or health care or fixing the schools or changing our economic policies is simply not true. I think the full range of our candidates are talking about those very issues. And frankly, there's not much difference between Howard Dean and other candidates on domestic issues, except that he takes sort of a Republican approach to education reform, which we can talk about later. But the other point the caller raises is it's kind of the perpetual chimera of some sort of hidden majority for either far left or far right political opinions. I'm sure Eric has read about this too. The best evidence I've ever read indicates that non-voters are very similar to voters in their basic attitudes. There's not some secret majority out there for a fundamentally different point of view than voters prefer. We all want voting rights to go up significantly. That's quite true. But it's kind of interesting that both the left and the right claim that there's a hidden majority out there among non-voters. And I simply don't think that's true. I think, obviously, if we can connect politics with the lives of people, touch them in the way that apparently Howard Dean has in some cases, we can maybe push up voting rates some. But there are a lot of reasons for the low level of voting in America, including the way we make people vote. So I don't think the lack of a hard left or hard right nominee is the answer.
All right, Jim, thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Williston, Vermont now and hear from Dan. Hello, Dan.
Hi. Well, Howard Dean was our governor for 11 years, and we're quite used to him up here. He was not regarded as an ultra-liberal in Vermont. In fact, he was felt to be rather conservative along the lines of Mr. Clinton, I believe. And it's very frustrating to hear ultra-conservatives trying to label Dr. Dean as a uber liberal, and what's even more frustrating is to hear the Democratic Leadership Council say that he is too liberal to be elected. I think he does energize people, as your guest said. He's smart, he's straightforward, and I think that's why he's exciting people who hear him and learn who he is.
So you think, Dan, that it would not be a good idea for the party to move to the left?
Well, I think an obvious move to the left, as in Mr. McGovern, for instance, could be suicidal. I don't think that Howard Dean would be moving the party to the left. His opposition to the war, I think, was at least as much an opposition to the way the war was carried out, and I think that's being proven correct now. But because he was opposed to the war, because he has signed a civil unions law in Vermont, which gives gays equal rights and responsibilities in their relationships.
Okay, got it, Dan. Let's hear what Eric has to say as well. Eric?
Well, I'm going to agree with both the caller and Ed that Howard Dean is not that liberal. It did surprise me 3 months ago when the DLC attacked him for being too liberal. I mean, he's changed his view on the death penalty. He's now for it. He's against gun control. He's a fierce advocate of a balanced budget. Ed's point about education reform is dead on. He's not that liberal. He's getting attention now for the purpose, for the reason that the caller from Iowa City identified. His opposition to the war opened the door to liberal activists, and then he steps through the door with passion and a plain speaking quality that is incredibly appealing in politics. You look at most successful politicians, and they have that ability. Bill Clinton did, Ronald Reagan did, LBJ did. So that, I believe, having been through this process 4 years ago, when you were just meeting people, whether through the media or individually, that's what carries you. That's what this is about, not liberalism. And Ed's right there. Most of the candidates are in about the same place on domestic issues. In fact, I would say John Kerry is more liberal than Howard Dean.
Ed, I want to hear from you on why the DLC viewed Dean with alarm, if you agree that it did. And also, isn't it dangerous for the Democrats to be perceived as anti-war? They've certainly been down that path before.
This thing all gets a little bit confusing. Our view about Governor Dean, and again, we don't hate the man. We don't think he's necessarily a disaster. We issued a warning to the party which is what we do traditionally, to not forget that we're about 40 points down to the Republicans on national security issues. That's been a traditional weakness of our party. Voters will not hear what we have to say about health care, education, the environment, gay and lesbian rights, you name it, if they are afraid that we will not protect them. That has been a historic problem with the Democratic Party. What Governor Dean did, and I have no idea whether it was out of passion, conviction, or opportunism, he used the anti-war sentiment to build himself into a first-tier candidacy. He used I call him sort of an ideological cowbird. He very shrewdly placed himself at the head of a very angry bunch of people that were very upset, not only at the Bush administration, but at their own party about
the
war.
Excuse me, Ed, I got to stop you right here because a lot of us are scratching our heads. What's a cowbird?
Oh, cowbird is a bird that takes over other birds' nests.
Okay. Never heard that one before.
That's a Southernism.
Okay.
And I think the passion behind the Dean candidacy up until now has mainly been about the war. And yes, we needed to issue a warning to Democrats to remember that in drawing differences between us and the Republicans right now, we shouldn't emphasize on the issue where the public least trusts us and least agrees with the anti-war point of view. That was our warning. Governor Dean does seem to be trying to reposition himself as a centrist, relying on his own record in Vermont, and I think the caller's absolutely right about it, as to whether he's going to be able to maintain that passion without focusing on making the election a retroactive referendum on Iraq, which, by the way, Democrats will lose if we do that. I don't know. That's one of the interesting things about the Dean candidacy.
All right, Eric, we only have about 30 seconds or so before we have to take a break, but what do you think about the danger for Democrats on this particular issue?
Well, I think it's far from settled. I mean, revisionism is an interesting thing. Shortly after the official war in Iraq stopped, everybody thought Howard Dean was in big trouble because he had opposed it. All of a sudden, he's not in big trouble because, of course, the closure of the war hasn't happened, may not happen for a long time. The very rationale for going to war is called into question with the intelligence falsifying. So the whole issue is up in the air, and I think that it's going to play out for months to come.
All right. We'll pick up on that point when we come back. Connection listeners, if you were advising the Democratic presidential candidates, would you say beer to the center if you want to win? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. We're talking about what strategy it will take for Democrats to win the White House in 2004. What hasn't worked in the past is leaning to the left, but what about now? Our guests are Ed Kilgore of the Democratic Leadership Council, who says that the way that works is aiming for the center, where most Americans are. Eric Hauser is a political strategist for progressive groups who believes if you get a good candidate, that's the way to go. That's going to get you to victory. And the way to go is definitely leftward. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. We invite you to join the conversation. Eric, I want to pick up with something that you were saying as we went to the break, because I didn't really give you enough time to develop the thought. It is fascinating how much the elephant in the room is national security. Even a war hero like Max Cleland of Georgia, who left three limbs in Vietnam, was defeated last year because he was accused of being insufficiently hawkish. That's the continuing tough issue for the Democrats, is it not? And particularly for someone who's being perceived as to the left.
I think it is, and I think it doesn't need to be. My version of liberalism is not automatically anti-use of American military force. I think a cogent debate about when and how to use it is not something to be afraid of. And I think after 9/11, this country is very understandably concerned about being protected. And I think that's a very legitimate thing and not at all at odds with progressivism, which my difference with the DLC or anyone else who's a moderate political professional is much more on the domestic side. I think you're right. It is the elephant in the room, and candidates and the party have to deal with it, especially in the wake of 9/11.
Ed, I want to follow up that point with John Kerry. When George Bush said a few days ago about the guerrilla activities in Iraq, said, bring them on. And one writer pointed out that he could have very easily said, Kerry could have very easily said, given his experience in Vietnam, you never say that about the troops. You don't invite people to attack you. And instead he had this two-paragraph, you know, it wasn't a good idea, blah, blah, blah. You know, on this issue in particular, again, don't the Democrats have to be very careful?
Yeah, I don't think that Senator Kerry can really be accused of being, unforthright on this. My God, he criticized the military aspects of the operations in Afghanistan while they were going on. Obviously, because of his biography, you know, his personal heroism in Vietnam, and the fact that he's one candidate that's been talking about this the whole time, and like the DLC, warning Democrats they can't simply change the subject. I think he will have some credibility, but I think several of the other candidates will too. I think so long as Americans are convinced that Democrats aren't simply conceding national security the way they did much in the 70s and the 80s, and sort of saying, well, if you're only concerned about domestic issues, vote for us, that's when we're in trouble. And that's why we're a little bit concerned when any candidate, not just Howard Dean, kind of plays to the Democratic galleries, to the really basically at most a plurality of a minority party, and forgets that we're going to have to convince millions and millions and millions of people that we'll protect them in a general election.
Well, and isn't Kerry the ideal candidate to push back on this very point?
Well, I don't know if he's the ideal candidate, but he certainly can, and I think he has. But I don't think Joe Lieberman or John Edwards have, or Bob Graham for that matter, have refused to talk about national security issues. And the fact that they supported the use of force resolution in Iraq may upset some Democratic primary and caucus voters, but it's where the American people generally are. And in any event, I think it's always a mistake in politics to make an election about something that's happened in the past, some sort of retroactive referendum on Iraq. And again, I'm not saying that Governor Dean has personally done that, but I think a lot of the people that supported him, that's exactly what they want.
All right, let's go to another one of our callers from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, I'm calling because I really feel that the fear culture that is being bred by the current administration and by the people that are running for the government is really not speaking to what the youth movement in America is all about. Like, we're really, really going for far left. Like, we need to get rid of the fear culture. We need to be very progressive. We need to, like, forget about being afraid of everything. We're the greatest country in the world. We're not going to go down because of a progressive candidate. We're going to go way, way up.
All right. Rachel, if you don't mind my asking, are you a college student or?
Yes, I go to the New School University.
Uh-huh. Okay. And you're planning, I would imagine, to get involved in this election?
Very much so. I'm a strong proponent of Kucinich, although I don't feel that he would have the backing to actually win the primary. We're not a big fan of Howard Dean at our school.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Rachel. Appreciate hearing from you.
Thank you.
Eric, what about that point? If you want the youth vote, you're really going to have to depart from where the party has been.
Well, I'll quote Ed. I disagree with the premise. I think the party has had a tendency since the 1890s of progressivism on domestic issues, and we've hit a bump in the road, and we shouldn't have, but there are good reasons for that. And now we're starting to get back to the true principles. The fascinating thing to me about this country is the potential we have to fulfill this promise, but the lack of health care, the lack of child care, the lack of education, the poor wages. When a third of the people who work in this country make less than $9 an hour, I mean, it's an extraordinary halt in progress in America toward a more fair and just society. And I think finally progressives are getting together instead of sniping at each other and saying we have an enormous opportunity in this country to build what it should be, to build where we were starting to get in the 60s. And let's go do it. It's an opportunity that I think young people see without certain coarse political bias because they're not professionals and they haven't lived through the last 30 years. And hearing that voice unadorned is very instructive to people who want to know what potential the country has and where voters who are new to it want to go.
And, gentlemen, there's another good-sized elephant in the room that I think we have to mention, and that's the fundraising gap. I mean, even at this point, George Bush has about, what, $34 million he's already raised? That's more than all the Democrats put together. What can the Democrats do to overcome that kind of fundraising handicap? Ed?
Well, if I can address the earlier point first, real quick, it's interesting, the Republicans were winning the youth vote, the 18 to 25 vote, throughout the 1980s. We got it back in 1992 and 1996. Now we're losing it again. And I don't think it's how far left the party goes that makes people, makes a party attractive to young people. It's whether they have a vision that relates to their lives. And part of the problem with the Democratic Party, and frankly, I think this is more true of the left than of centrists, is they want to focus domestic policy on, keeping anybody from touching Medicare and Social Security. That was basically the message of the Democratic Party in the 2002 midterm elections. Prescription drug benefit and don't touch Social Security. Now, what does that mean to an 18 to 25-year-old, focusing all of your energy on retirement security for seniors? We have to have a message that speaks to everybody's lives and everybody's generations. Then we'll be competitive with young people again. As far as money goes, I don't know. Eric may have a better idea about this than I do. I think there's some recent signs that there simply is a saturation level in terms of television advertising that may actually begin to turn voters off. We saw that a little bit in the South Dakota Senate elections last year. And I think the use of the Internet to organize and motivate candidates that Dr. Dean has done such a good job in is an indication that some of the old-fashioned methods of reaching voters may be more cost-effective than just big television money. So maybe it won't matter that the Republicans have this big advantage.
Hmm. All right, let's hear from David now. He's on the line from Chesapeake, Virginia. Hello, David.
Hi, how are you? Listen, I just want to make a point of something. We've allowed the conservatives, the right-wingers, to poison our water hole. Liberals used to be a very acceptable term. We're proud of it. And now we won't even call ourselves liberals anymore. We call ourselves progressives. We allowed them to associate liberalism with socialism, communism, so on. Well, at the same time, their agenda, their left-wing, their right-wing agenda is not a whole lot different. And this sounds awfully radical, but it's not. From some of the things that Mussolini was doing in 1933 in Italy. On what day do we go on the attack and say, okay, you guys, we start defining their agendas. So we start defining their labels as conservatives because, some of this totalitarianism we see in Patriot 1 and Patriot 2 is just not acceptable, and we have to sit back and say so. So
hold on, David. Let me ask you a question, if you can hang with us for one more second. Does that mean to be anti-war?
No, ma'am. I'm saying to be a critic of the war means you're not patriotic because you're some sort of traitor in some facts.
So just redefine the terms of the debate.
Redefine the word. Dare anyone say fascism? I mean, they call us communists. Dare anyone say that they're tending towards fascism, totalitarianism?
Then who are you looking at, David? Do you have a candidate?
I really don't. I don't see anyone who's. I'm in a quandary. I would almost be a vote for Nader as a protest. Because I don't see anyone stepping forward and saying, here's who we are, here's what we stand for, here's where the Democratic Party should go, and here's what we're going to do. This is my platform, and this is what I stand for.
David, we thank you so much for the call.
Yes, ma'am.
So what about that, Eric? Is that the kind of message that needs to energize that 60% that's not involved at the moment?
Well, I think there are two parts. One is I agree, of course, that we have become afraid of being called liberals, and I don't think we should be. I think what liberalism stands for are the very best virtues that America can aspire to. I think the point, and I am going to agree and disagree with Ed on this, the 60% of people who don't vote, I agree that they are very much like the people who do vote, but have been turned off for a whole number of reasons. I think deep down, many of them are people who are struggling with day-to-day life in their economic circumstances. And liberals have made a huge mistake over the years in talking down to these people. I don't care really what their political affiliation is, but I know that my domestic agenda or liberalism's domestic agenda is exactly what fits this person's life. And when liberals, you know, come off of our high perch and can talk to folks in normal tones and listen to them and sit around the gas station or the Walmart and understand them, then we have a chance to say our agenda is your agenda. But if all we do is preach and use big words, they are either going to stay away or turn to someone that they can have some faith in. And George Bush can do that. He's an effective politician on that level. So, yeah, we should be proud of being liberals. But if we keep looking down on people who are high school graduates, we're killing ourselves. And that's what makes me mad about liberalism.
Mm. Ed, I want to ask you, the headlines for the last couple of days have been about the size of the deficit, $455 billion this year. It's projected $500 billion next year. Makes me hearken back to 92 when it's the economy, stupid, was the mantra.
Yeah, and I think it's very important for Democrats, regardless of what they call themselves, to connect the dots between the fiscal policies of this administration and the economic policies that are affecting their lives, just as Eric says. I mean, basically, what this administration doing is going on an incredible borrowing binge from future generations and from middle-class taxpayers in the future to reward their favored wealthy constituencies with tax cuts that they don't need and that don't help the economy. I think if we can keep hammering that message in, then, I don't think we need to have any debates as to whether fiscal discipline or economic inequality is the issue. They're both the issue and they're connected. And I hope we can really be united on that message going forward.
All right. Well, we thank you both so much. Ed Kilgore is Policy Director of the Democratic Leadership Council. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you.
Eric Hauser is President of the Hauser Group, which advises progressive organizations. Thanks so much, Eric, for being with us.
Thank you.
Earlier, we spoke with Megan Scott and Brian Tibbetts, volunteers in Iowa City, for Howard Dean. We also want to say a special thanks to Dennis Reese at WSUI in Iowa City. And Connection listeners, you can continue the discussion on our website at theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Our intern is Kate Zernowski. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection.